This conference will.
This week, we're going to talk about where you go from here, because I imagine that you're doing this course because you want to go somewhere different to where you've been, whether you change your outward circumstances or whether you're just thinking primarily of changing what goes on in your own head, in the first instance anyway. So over the weeks, I'd like to think that you've learned a lot more about your abusive partner, your relationship, and yourself. You've learned what made you susceptible to your abusive partner, you've learned what your abusive partner truly is, and you've learned what really makes it so hard to leave. In this teleclass, we're going to look at where you go from here, because that's the hard one for abused women. We've been taught not to believe in ourselves so well and for such a long time that it can be hard to take back the reins of our own lives. So let's start with a question. Where do you really want to go from here? How much have you even thought about where you go from here? And let's unmute the lines for a moment so you can have the opportunity to answer that question. How much have you thought about where you go from here? And what do you really want to go on with in your life? So if you can just think about it, because these are the kind of things that women don't really give a lot of thought to, where you really want to go from here and where you really want to go with your life.
That's something I have been thinking about, because as a result of my relationship, I quit my job and I moved and I, you know, changed all my contact information. So, you know, I've been thinking about going back to school and all this, but I mean, I'm 45 years old and I'm, you know, not, it's not the end of my life, but it's a crazy to be starting from scratch. I mean, I don't have children, which is maybe a good thing just because if they're not caught in this upheaval process. But it's a very good question. I've been seeing a career counselor to think about careers. But it really does make you think about where you want to be in the world. I don't even know if I want to stay in this part of the world. So it's a good question. And I think for so many years, I mean, I was only with my abusive ex for 4 years, but for 4 years, I didn't think about myself at all. You know, I was 100% preoccupied with him and his moods and his failure in life and, you know, and being supportive of him, that it's almost a challenge to think about myself and think about what I want and what I like.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that is a challenge. I've been reading a lot. That helps a bit, but I can't just adopt somebody else's life plan. I really have to come up with my own, and that's been a challenge, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and what about you, Helen?
Well, I think that very similar, and I think that, you know, all those years before was about what everybody else was doing and how I fitted in with that and helped make it happen. And so, yes, I similarly have had to ponder the same things over the last year. And I too left my work and I too moved house. And, yes, work was such a big part of my life and still is, really. And I don't... I may go back to it in a different form, though, definitely in a different form. And so I'm a little bit further down the track, I think. I've had some time to think about it. And I've built myself a studio, and hopefully I'll be able to combine my old work and some of the creative work that I have put on hold for all those years. So I think I'll probably combine the both. Some sort
Fantastic.
Of... sorry?
Fantastic. What kind of artwork?
I do textiles and paper and sort of modern embroidery and... Yeah, lots of textile work, and I've taken up some painting, some naive painting, but I'm very interested in healing work and group work. I've trained in facilitation and group work processes, and I've done a lot in the past, and I would really like to combine my my welfare work and my artwork together. And my studio's big enough to do that. Mm. So I'm a little bit further down the track, but I'm still not sure totally. I still need to feel more settled about it. I still have a lot of trouble putting my stuff first. Intellectually, yeah. No problem, but actually what's happening inside is a struggle still after all this time.
Yeah. I can relate to that. And what I'm hearing from both of you is that you're thinking about what you want to do in the world, but not a great deal about how you want to be in the world.
Yes.
And that really was the question that I was asking you, in a sense, because it's an important one for you, I think. What do you want to... Where do you want to go with your life? What do you want to have in your life? How do you want your life to be?
I think I want my dignity and self-respect back, and to be a more integrated person after what I've been through, and more, I'm not quite sure what the word is, I've lost the word, but more, being really true to yourself. There's a word for it, and I think it starts with I, but it'll come to me later. But more who you truly are, and comfortable with that, and being able to express that and show it in the world.
Authenticity, perhaps.
Authentic, that's the word. Yes. That's the word.
Yes.
Exactly. I lost it.
Before we go on, I'm going to challenge you a little bit on what you said, because I hear what you're saying, but I can't see what it means. So how will you know you've got your dignity back? What will be different?
Well,
what
I think...
What will show up in your life that's different?
Yes, well, I think I'm a long way down that path because I chose to move, to live differently, to live independently, and to say out loud, this is what I'm going to do because it's important to me, and I don't want what I've had before anymore. So I think that I'm down the path, but I'm not totally there because I still get pulled.
Right. And the other piece of it was, I was going to say to you, if you want your dignity back, you can have it back right now. You can have your dignity back and still struggle with removing the hooks from your flesh.
Yes.
Dignity, none of these feelings that we want have to be an end result. You can have your dignity back right now. There is a lot of dignity in being where you both are at the moment and doing what you're doing to create a life for yourselves. Now, there is massive dignity, massive stature in doing that, if you choose to believe it. And that's the point.
Yes. Yep.
You see, the feelings that you want, you're actually entitled to step into right now. Why not? When do you earn them? You have them if you choose to focus on them. The other half of the question, which is how will you know when you've got this back, is what specifically will show up in your life that's not showing up now? And this is a question I keep asking you both, really. What will show up in your life that will tell you that you've got it as you want it? And abstract nouns like dignity and authenticity, much as I love them too, don't take you very far, because when you say, well, how does that authenticity show up? You go, well, I remember when I started out down my journey, I used to see all these quizzes in books, all these things, questionnaires and personal development books that you're meant to fill in. And as a sort of rather arrogant PhD, I used to look at them and say, I don't need to fill this in. I already know what I think. Until the day when I did try to fill them one in, and I realized that actually I didn't know what I thought. That what I thought was thinking wasn't really very much clarity at all. I was barely thinking and trying to describe my vision and make it clear and attainable was something I'd never really considered. So that's what I would urge you to do, to start looking at the vision for your whole life, not just what you'll be doing, but how your life will be, how you'll be living it, how you'll be feeling, who will be around you, the quality of friends you'll have, the quality of the life, what specifically you'll be doing, all of that stuff. So instead of having this professional goal, you're creating a richly worked fabric that is your life. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes. Yes. It's helpful.
So that's a lot harder in a sense. And it's also a lot more exciting because once we start having the dream, we can create it. But when we're just sort of agonizing about, shall we do this, or shall we do that, shall we do this, or shall we do that, life can be a very thin affair.
Yes.
So I'd urge you to think what you really want to your life to look like. So one of the shared characteristics of abused women is that, in the main, we forget how to dream if we ever really knew. So what do I mean by dream? I guess I mean visualize. And what I mean by visualize is really see, hear, and experience, so that you can almost touch whatever it is that you want, that it becomes clearer and clearer to you. If you're like me, during my abusive marriage, I sometimes had fragile, anemic dreams. More often, I had no vision for the future at all. My dreams at best were either about my husband magically changing into a partner who smiled at me with his eyes, that never happened, or about doom and gloom and my loveless life without him. What I'm asking you to do is quite different. I'm asking you to start to develop your visualizing skill. You can't know what you can have in the months and years ahead. And you may have absolutely no idea how you could possibly get it, but you need to start visualizing. You need to feed into your unconscious mind the awareness that you can have much, much more than you have now. How will it come about? I don't know. But I do know that when you put your unconscious mind on the case, wonderful things will happen. Your unconscious mind is not unlike having eBay inside your own head. The only difference being that you never have to pay for what you get, and there is no auction involved. But just as you can find everything you could ever be looking for on eBay, so you can find it inside your own unconscious mind. And it's actually less trouble finding it than it is going through about a zillion pages of stuff on eBay. Perhaps you can tell from this that I'm not a great eBay shopper. It's true. I find it just too much like hard work. Whereas finding things in your unconscious mind, locating them and bringing them into being is not. Let me tell you an experience I had recently with a client who's brought up in a very rough area indeed. It was one of those areas where you had to be a good street fighter to survive. In fact, he did more than just survive. He worked his butt off and managed to get out of that area and put that whole life behind him. He made it into a much, much better place. As he put it, he had dragged himself out of the gutter and into a far more attractive lifestyle. He now mixes with people from a rather more privileged background than his own, and they love him for the person he is. But he often feels very uncomfortable around them. He says he doesn't have the life skills for the world in which he now lives. Having worked with me for a while, do you think I would find that a helpful belief? Of course I don't. As he saw it, his life skills largely centered on surviving in a difficult environment and being a hard man. He felt that he didn't know how to fit gracefully into the world in which he now moves. I asked him Did he know anyone who had the skills that he would love to have? He thought about it for a little while, and then he nodded. He did. So we did a little exercise lasting about 15 minutes, an exercise that we can do at the end of this call, all about downloading from another person, that other person in his case, the skills that he lacked. And you know what? It really worked for him. Why? Because he suddenly realized that all the things he wanted and believed were out there were actually inside him. They had been stored in the treasure house of his unconscious mind, just as many treasures are stored in your unconscious mind. But treasures are a fat lot of use if you never unearth them, if you don't even believe you can unearth them. The nature of your unconscious mind is such that it sees and stores everything, and it will offer up to you whatever you ask it for, especially if you ask it nicely. So I would invite you to think that you have your very own internal eBay to draw on at all times. It costs you nothing. It's quick and easy to find the resource you want. So why on earth wouldn't you? So if you can't visualize very easily what you want your future life to look like, then I would urge you to think of other people's lives that appeal to you. Don't go for the silly stuff like the film star lifestyle, because you really don't know how they live. You're just focusing on the material stuff. But think about people you know. Everybody knows a few people whose lifestyle and relationships they admire. Start to think about what's good about the way they relate to each other and the world, and incorporate that into your vision of what you want for your future. A few years before I finally showed my husband the door, we went on an unusually miserable holiday together in Turkey. One day, we went on a very noisy, very unpleasant boat trip. There were lots of young families, but one stood out for me. It was a couple with two boys. The wife was plain, largish, and perfectly ordinary looking. Her husband was more attractive than she was, although not massively so. Because my husband and I weren't talking, I had plenty of time to observe all of this. But what struck me about this man was that whenever he looked at her, he smiled with his eyes. It wasn't something I had ever really thought about before, but on that day, I realized that my husband never, ever smiled with his eyes. At some point, I included that in my vision of the future. Why wouldn't you want a partner whose whole face lights up when he looks at you because he values you so much? Why wouldn't you choose to be the kind of person who is surrounded by people who love and value you, people who are always supportive of you? Can you really have a life filled with people like that? Undoubtedly, provided you start to believe it. But let's be honest, I'm guessing that, like me, you're used to having people around you, and when I say people, I don't just mean your abusive partner, who gave you to understand that you weren't valuable, that you took a lot of putting up with, and even that you were a millstone around their neck. And that's how you came to accept being treated. That's why you've been able to tolerate it. Clearly, you cannot afford ever to tolerate that in your life again. So coming back to the question we started from, where do you go from here? We'll use the same sort of 8-option format that we've been using in previous weeks. Option 1, you can hold on to your old beliefs, attitudes, hopes, and dreams, and what will that get you? The short answer is that it will get you more of the same. The reality is that it will get you an even worse outcome than you have already had. So option 1 is simply not an option. Sitting tight and hoping that things will change of their own accord is not an option. Why should anything change until you make the effort and the commitment to change it? Option number 2. diaper time or nappy time in the UK. If you're looking change in the face, the chances are that the future looks like a very frightening place, hence the name diaper time. You may not be aware, as I was not until relatively recently, that a high level of fear and anxiety about the future is a feature of your abusive programming. I haven't heard anyone who I've worked with say, I don't know quite where I'm going, but I have faith in my own resources that things will work out for me because I will make them work out for me. They don't say it. Your abuser is a head worker. If from time to time he opens the prison door for you, it makes him look good, especially if he has you so well trained that you don't feel confident enough to venture out. Has he done that to you? Undoubtedly. Every time you tell yourself that nobody else will ever want you, or you can't manage on your own, or you can't parent on your own, or no other man measures up to him in terms of attractiveness, presence, dress, or whatever else, every time you tell yourself something along those lines, what you're really saying is that you're afraid to step out of your own prison. And you think the outside world is simply a continuation of the prison you've been confined to. Once you leave your abusive partner, there is only one prison and one jailer, and that's you. Whenever you feel the fear or the anxiety, and it's perfectly normal to feel a lot of fear or anxiety for quite a while, that's a signal to keep moving. The fear of action, the hopelessness and the negativity are feelings that have been programmed into you to keep you from taking action. In this instance, those feelings are not keeping you safe, they're just paralyzing you. And they are just feelings. When you find yourself slipping into that way of thinking, you can ask yourself, what's the worst that can possibly happen? And keep asking until you get to the core of the issue. So suppose your fear is about being penniless. Ask yourself, what is the worst that can possibly happen? And you answer, I could lose everything I have. Then you ask the question again, what's the worst that can possibly happen if you lose everything you have? And the answer could be, I'll be streets with nothing and no one to turn to. I'll be totally alone and abandoned. It will be cold and dangerous and I won't survive. And if you ask yourself the question again, what's the worst that can possibly happen if you don't survive? An answer will come back like, I'll die. And then again, what's the worst that can possibly happen if you die? And the answer, I'll be dead. And what's so awful about being dead? I won't be alive anymore. So does that mean that there's something valuable to you about being alive? Yes, there is. What's valuable to you then about being alive? And you might answer, my children, or waking up in the morning, smelling the roses, having the promise of another day. You know what matters to you. So if those things are important to you, if life is important to you, will you not do the things you have to do to ensure that you protect your life? In the end, the cataclysmic fears are all about abandonment, about being completely and utterly alone, unsupported and unloved. And that is actually the way you've been living in an abusive relationship. So it's a fear of the past, that you project, or the present that you're projecting into the future. What if you choose to believe that separating from your abusive partner will allow you to connect with other people in a far more meaningful way than you have done for a long time? Think about it. Your relationship with family has doubtless suffered because of being with him. Your relationship with children has suffered because of your association with him. Your association with friends has weakened because of your relationship with him. your work, or at least your work satisfaction, has probably suffered because you're obsessing about him. Your relationship with work colleagues has probably suffered because you're so fixated on your relationship problems. And your commitment to your own self-care has doubtless suffered because of your focus on healing a moribund relationship. So tell me, how could you possibly feel any more unsupported and unloved and alone than you do right now? Moving on to option number 3, uncharted territory. There is one thing that you have in an abusive relationship that other people do not have. You can actually predict the future with certainty. Of course you say that you can't, but this isn't really true. For as long as you focus on what you'd really like to happen and delude yourself that it can, it's possible to be surprised when the relationship disappoints you again and again. But when you become aware of what is really going on, then you know exactly what is bound to happen. Life in an abusive relationship has a grim predictability. There may be better times, but they will always end in relationship breakdown, hurt, and disappointment. When you finally close the door on the abusive kingdom and walk into the outside world, you have very little idea of where your life will take you. Sure, you have the fantasy of extreme loneliness, with maybe just a mongrel or a stray kitten for company. But that presupposes that you'll do absolutely nothing with your life, and that is nonsense. If I were to offer you one piece of advice for your future, it would be to try to do one thing each day that takes you slightly outside your comfort zone. By this, I don't mean get on an internet dating website and start the process of selecting another partner as soon as possible. I mean challenge some of your abusive beliefs in a sensitive way. If your partner has told you that you're unlovable, and it's a fairly reasonable guess that he has, then start to mix with more people than you have, or new people. And here's the thing. It's not enough to simply get out there and mix with people if you carry the burden of his loathing within you. There are 3 things that you'll want to do before you go among people to ensure that you get the outcome you deserve. First, a little exercise that we'll do right now about laying his negativity down. But we've got a bit of a bad echo on the line, so it might be an idea if you
want to mute yourself.
Yes. Star 6. I think the echo actually came on with you, Helen. Hello? Right. And if by any chance the line fails, please just send me an email, someone. It shouldn't. So I'd like us to do a little exercise right now about laying your partner's negativity down. What I'd like you to do is close your eyes right now, take a couple of deep breaths, and have a sense of shutting out colors, distractions, noises, and any extraneous thoughts. Just stay in the moment with my voice. And I want you to visualize the burden of your partner's negativity towards you. You've been carrying it for quite some time now. I don't know whether you've been storing it inside you and it's been filling you up like some dark, noxious substance, or whether it's been a weight on your shoulders or a constant blaring noise in your head. But you'll know. You'll know that how that negativity has been weighing down on you, what it looks like. So I want you to visualize it. Really see it, hear it, sense it. Notice everything you can about it. And what I'd like you to do now is either lift it off your shoulders or out of your head or off your body or roll it away from you or do whatever you need to create that distance between it and you. And if you're struggling to do that on your own and you need help, then you can call on anyone in your life who you know or who you have ever known and loved and felt was really there for you, and you can get them to help you with it. And just take that time and use that support if you need to. And remove that burden from you physically. Create a distance between you and it. And I want you to look at that burden when you've taken it away from you. And decide what you're going to do with it. How you're going to either give it back to your abusive partner who has to take it, or else destroy it so that nobody needs to have it anymore. And I don't know what you want to do with it, but I'm sure you'll know what's exactly right for you. And in your own mind, in your own mind's eye, you can just do whatever it is that you need to do to dispense with that negativity. To take it off. To take it out of your world. And you can just do that. And notice what happens to the you that does that. What difference that makes. Now when you've done that, you can just open your eyes and come back into the room and notice how that feels. Notice where you feel lighter and clearer. It may be your shoulders, it may be your head, maybe one of many, many places. Notice how much lighter and clearer it feels because you don't need to carry the burden of your partner's negativity. Being ever such a nice person, you did for the longest time, and now you know you don't need to. And now let's move on to the second of these three things. If you're anything like I was, and anything like a lot of women who've lived in very difficult circumstances, then you may be a little withdrawn, cautious, and intense when you go into social situations. There may be some very good reasons for being that way, but do you think it really helps? Human beings are amazingly intuitive, even when they can't explain what they experience consciously. So if you're carrying a weight of shame, fear, worry, and a desperate need to be heard, you won't be a bundle of laughs to be around. And more to the point, you won't do yourself justice. Listen carefully now, because this is important. Because you have a lot of problems, that doesn't mean that you have to project yourself as Mrs. I have the weight of the world on my shoulders, or Mrs. Life is really tough for me right now. It doesn't even mean you have to feel like Mrs. I have the weight of the world on my shoulders, or Mrs. Life is really tough for me right now. That's every bit as appealing as walking into a room and ending up in a conversation with a woman who's pregnant for the first time and recounting every gory, horrific detail of your difficult childbirth, from the 320-hour labor to the 94 pints of blood you had to be given and the 5,000 stitches you needed to the disaster to your figure and your pelvic floor. Do you think that poor woman wants to know? Of course she doesn't. Telling her, which women do all the time to other women, is merely about dumping on her, and nobody likes to be dumped on. It doesn't even really make you feel good. The only way, possible way it can make you feel better is if the poor girl is so terrified she goes into labor, or your childbirth story is more awful than anyone else's and you win the competition. So here's the thing. You have a lot of difficulties to deal with right now. If you sit down and watch your favorite television program, can you shut them out for 20 minutes or an hour or however long it lasts? If you're reading a book that really interests you, can you lose sight of them for a while? If you're engaged in cooking or doing a piece of work or anything that really interests you, can you lose sight of them for a while? If you say you can't, I'm afraid I don't believe you. Even I could. We all can for a while. And what that means is that you can put your problems down for a while. In fact, it would be insane not to. Why? Because, think about it, your problems are incredibly loyal. They've never run off yet, have they? You can put them down for a while and they just won't run off. They won't run off at the first opportunity and attach themselves to somebody else, will they? They'll just wait patiently for you, just the way they always have. That being the case, it would be a real shame not to ask them to wait quietly when you go into a group of people so that you can show these people your most engaging face. Because when you do that, you start to get feedback about what an engaging and delightful person you are. And the feedback will very quickly start to nurture and heal you. You'll begin to get a sense of yourself as a lovable and easily loved person, which will be a great help to you in all your dealings. And, as I already said, you have no need to worry about your problems. They'll be there waiting for you, worrying about when you'll pick them up again and get back to making them feel important. So the second thing that you'll want to do, either leave your problems in the cloakroom or the bathroom before you go into any social situation if you care to see it that way. Or if you prefer, you could make a point of tethering them to a doorpost or door handle on your way into a building, secure in the knowledge that they'll be waiting there patiently for you on your way out. Or else, if you prefer, and this is my favorite, you could visualize dropping these tiresome creatures off as some kind of problem crash on your way to wherever you're going. And you could have a lot of fun thinking about the problem crash, visualizing all the problems there, your own and other people's, all with their miserable little faces and their dark clothing, all scowling at each other and maybe being competitive with each other and saying things like, "You think that's bad? Well, let me tell you how hard, tough it is for me." None of them wanting to play any games or have any fun or listen to any great fairy stories. They'd probably even make a point of not enjoying the cookies and milk. But that's for them to sort out. They are problems, so being miserable is part of their job description. It's something that floats their boat. Your sanity is leaving them in the creche for a while, just like when you had a break from your own children, assuming that you've had children. And now on to the third thing. I have a very dear friend who is the ultimate alpha male. He's also the world's best networker. He has a genius for walking into rooms and turning everyone into his friend and groupie. He can normally do that in 15 minutes flat. It's a skill he has in spades. It's a skill I lack. Until one day I decided I was sick of shuffling into rooms as invisibly as possible, telling myself some pointless story about how I was shy, and the truth is, I used all those occasions to tell myself some elements of my old familiar victim story. I can't do this because... On that day, I decided to learn the lessons from my alpha friend. We'll come back to how to do that either later on in this call or on the next one. The reason for not launching in straight into that now is that I don't want to absolutely submerge you with valuable stuff for fear of it just washing over you. But for the moment, I'd like to share with you the realization that made a huge difference to me. My alpha male friend allowed other people to like him. In fact, he made it as easy as possible for people to like him. How did he do that? He was warm and funny. He cracked jokes. He smiled. He was interested in other people. His focus was on engaging with them, not wondering whether they would engage with him. So he made it as easy as possible for them to engage with him, and guess what? They did. Now, I'm not my alpha male friend. I'm not as funny or as charismatic. But the same technique still worked beautifully. And I'm aware we could spend the whole rest of this session focusing on this one idea, but doing so would mean missing out on other vital information. So we'll come back to exactly how to do it. For now, I invite you to take this one idea on board. It's really easy for you to make it easy for people to like you and experience that liking. The moment you tether your problems to the doorpost in social or professional situations, you're free to connect with other people in a way that will start to fill your self-worth tank quickly and easily. So do it. Do it not least because every time you do it, you'll be putting one more piece of your future great life into place. It will help you create that vision and bring that vision into reality. And on to option number 4. The abusive kingdom is a world in which there really is no choice. The only choice you've had is whether you keep quiet and settle for less than you deserve, or whether you walk straight into a fight. That's not the way it is in the outside world. I'm not saying that from now on you'll only ever meet nice people and have happy experiences, because that's not entirely true. But what is true is that from now on, you will always have the opportunity to shape your experiences. From now on, you don't have to live in your abusive partner's black or white, either or world. Let's look briefly at a couple of the scenarios abused women eternally play out in their head. Either I stay with my abusive partner, or I'll be a lonely old woman with only a cat for company if I'm lucky. Or else, either I stay with him or I'll be poor forever. What lies behind those ideas is actually the belief, either I stay with my abusive partner, or I will have no power over my future at all. How does that one work? As you well know, when you're with an abusive partner, he does everything he can to ensure that you have little or no power over your present. Why else would he pick the fights he does? Why would he turn every possible scenario into a potential minefield? Pat Craven doesn't call him the Dominator for nothing. Why has your Dominator programmed you to believe that you're powerless in the present with him? Because he wants to keep you in his power in the future. Because he knows that if you're to realize that you could be happy, and quite possibly radiantly happy, you'd be off like a shot. He knows you always have choices. The people around you know that you have choices. That's why they can get so frustrated when you sink into paralysis. Only you didn't know that. Not only do you have choices, but they're choices worth making. What would you like to be doing 1 year from now? I'm not interested in the answer that goes, a year from now I'd like to be with a partner who loves me. That doesn't really tell me much, and it doesn't tell you much. What do you want your life to look like? What do you want it to feel like? How do you want to know that a partner loves you? What do you want to love about him? How do you want to feel when you wake up in the morning? How do you want to feel as you go through your day? And if it takes longer than a year, because we can't be prescriptive about this, are you prepared to invest that time to create the life you've always hoped for? You have the choice to make that happen. In fact, you have choices all along the line that you can take to make that happen. One of the reasons you, like me, ended up in an abusive relationship for way too long is because we fudged those choices. When I stayed in that car with my husband after he'd shouted at me for the first time, the choice I made was to abdicate choice. You've done it too. And sooner or later, you'll be tempted to do it again. But I'm going to do everything I can to spoil your fun for you. in the future, you'll recognize you're abdicating your right to free choice by the sinking feeling you experience when you fall back into the old ways. This is a sign to yourself. How do I really want to do this? Do I want to do this the old way? And if not, how many other ways can I think of doing it? What do I have to do to arrive at a way that works for me? Where can I find the win-win situation in all of this? In fact, how many win-win ways of dealing with this can I find? There is a saying that the person with the most flexible behaviors wins. From now on, that can start to be you. Option number 5, happiness. I've said it before and I'll say it again because it certainly bears repeating. You don't ever have to wait for happiness or defer happiness until all the things you want to happen fall into place. That is, unless you're prepared to wait forever. When you're in an abusive relationship, happiness is what will arrive one day when your partner is finally body snatched and replaced with a much, much nicer alien. And there's a fat chance of that happening. As Jamie Smart always says, today is practice for tomorrow. So if today is practice for tomorrow, why wouldn't you start choosing happiness for yourself today? Start practicing. Start getting the skill of being happy with whatever causes for happiness you have right now. Maybe you've seen the movie Invictus, and maybe you haven't. It's fantastic and uplifting, and it draws its title, as Nelson Mandela drew his inspiration, Keep Going, from this poem by William Ernest Henley. And I will read it to you, and it might be a really good idea for me to send it to you in case you don't quite get it over the phone. So, Invictus goes like this. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. And you are still the mistress of your fate and the captain of your soul. However bad your situation may have been, however bad your situation still is, you are not imprisoned as Mandela was. You're relatively free, and even your present life has some pleasures. So here's the thing. You could say, my life is so hard because all I have is X or Y. Or you could say, because my life is hard and I get pleasure from X or Y, that proves to me that my capacity for happiness is still undimmed. It cannot be extinguished, or else it would have failed me completely a long time ago. So from now on, I intend to focus on growing and expanding that happiness, magnifying that happiness that has remained at the core of my being. Because I know that when I do that, I can take happiness in so many things in my life. I can take pleasure in many, many things, and the more I experience pleasure and happiness for myself, the more people who will increase my pleasure and happiness will be spontaneously, irresistibly attracted to me. And what I'll do after this call is I will send you a link to a very interesting interview that I had recently with Shoshana Garfield, because it fits very much with this, that however bad her situation was, she learnt to take pleasure in the moment also. Option number 6, identity. Your abusive partner worked really hard at undermining your identity as a woman, a partner, a lover, a mother if appropriate, a competent professional worker, and a human being. He did his best to devalue who you are and everything you stand for. And you probably fell for it. But that doesn't make it true. He would try to undermine your identity as a woman. But don't forget, he's no connoisseur of women. He hates women. So his judgment doesn't really count. He would criticize you as a partner, because that has always proved to be a brilliant way to mask his shortcomings as a partner. Your alleged selfishness confers sainthood on him. Nobody else could ever put up with you, right? And how could the sexual controller not criticize you as a lover? He isn't interested in using the act of making love as a way of growing intimacy, trust, unconditional acceptance, and, well, love. It's not in his interest to make you feel safe, supported, cherished, and equal. By the same token, he cannot acknowledge your skill, expertise, and value in your professional sphere, because that would mean conceding an area of your life that he does not dominate. So the better you are, the more he will look for ways to cut you down to size, his size. When I started my own catering business many, many years ago, my husband was quick to tell me that I didn't know the first thing about business. That was true. I didn't. Now, a supportive partner might have pointed me towards someone he knew who could help, or he might have bought a useful book or two, or he might have suggested a course that I or maybe both of us could go on to learn about running a business. But what did he actually do? Well, by now, you should know the answer to that. What does an abusive man always do when he denounces a fatal fault or flaw that you have? What he does is he holds himself up to you as the shining example. And that's exactly what my husband did. From the minuscule granule of his infinite wisdom, he told me that precisely everything I was doing was wrong and needed to be done quite differently. The only trouble was that he didn't have a clue what he was talking about. He was a doctor. He didn't have a clue how to run a business. And he was far too arrogant to even wonder whether this might be the case. As ever, he knew that he was a much more evolved human being than I was, and the best thing to do with me was to tell me what a failure I was. Had he known anything at all about running a business, he might have known that that's a poor way to get the best out of employees or work colleagues. As for the things your abusive partner said about you as a human being, I'm going to ask you a hard question. It's time for an honest response. How much does he contribute to the well-being of the people around him? Think about it for a moment. How great is the contribution that he makes to the well-being of people around him? Usually it's small to non-existent. My husband was a physician who looked after the health of his patients. But the vast majority of them hated him despite his considerable professional competence because he had such an unpleasant manner. I do know that you get the occasional abuser who's a pillar of the church or other community. When that happens, he may do useful work in the outside world. But how much does he do for the family and the people allegedly closest to him? What does their lives look like? Have they gone off the rails or failed to grow into productive people? No abuser is a valid judge of your worth as a human being. He's the very last person on earth who will ever offer you a fair assessment of your value. Because he really doesn't like you. That's part of his job description. So he'll reflect a distorted, negative view of you back to you. It's as predictable as it is wrong. you do a lot better to make a point of listening to what other people say, people who like and value you. Option number 7, achievement. At a rough guess, I'd probably say that your own life has been on hold for almost as long as you've been with your abusive partner. That's only right, isn't it? I mean, the poor poppet couldn't bear it if you outshone him, could he? Living through an abusive relationship is like being tempered by fire. The process is not a pleasant experience, but something precious comes out to the other side of it. You may not know what that is yet, but that's okay. I invite you to hold on to the belief that if you're just patient and curious with yourself, you will find out. Like the woman who found that her musical ability was of interest to the industry. She thought she was washed up, old, talentless, and with no life ahead of her. Pardon me. She was wrong. The theory is that most of us spend most of our time functioning on about 5% of brain capacity. That's under normal conditions. Abused women would be barely functioning on half of that, say 2% of brain capacity, because they spend so much time obsessing about the rights and wrongs of their abusive relationship. What happens when you not only claim the other 3% because you stopped obsessing about your energy vampire, but also use some of the techniques you've learned over the past weeks to access even more brain power? If you only access 1% more, that would be a massive increase in what you'd previously harnessed. If you access another 2% or even 3% or 4% more, you begin to imagine what you can do with it. Every technique that we've used to get you to access the power of your unconscious mind is a very powerful way of upping the amount of brain capacity you use and improving the results you get. These results are simple, quick to use, and absolutely free. If you use them and apply them on a regular basis to the challenges you face, you must increase your brain capacity. How can better results not follow? The only question is, why on earth wouldn't you do it? Why on earth, when you're feeling stuck, wouldn't you use one of these techniques? Finally, option number 8, a relationship. Nobody is so old, ugly, horrid, or needy that they can't find another relationship tomorrow or after tomorrow. Your abusive partner, and mine, managed it when they found you and me. So they weren't that old or ugly, perhaps. But the bottom line is that they are rather horrid and needy, and we still fell for them. Any fool can find a bad relationship in very short order. Your job now, if you so desire, is to grow into your own brilliance so that you can attract a relationship and a partner that's worthy of you. But whether or not you want another relationship in your life, you must take the time to grow yourself. The better the relationship you have with your own self, the happier you'll be. And the more likely you are to attract great people into your life, including a great partner. You're entitled to it. Bad things have happened in your life because, not knowing any better, as a vulnerable adult, you allowed destructive people too much access to your life. That was then. This is now. Now you have the knowledge and the ability to say no to people who are likely to bring darkness into your life. If you feel like you're running into trouble, you can always contact me for individual coaching, help and support. You can join my inner circle for that ongoing support. In the next 2 weeks, we'll have a very exhaustive question and answer session, and we'll do some testing of your perceptions to see how far you've come with your thinking. I know that some of you have listened to every teleclass without ever being on the calls because of other commitments. for the next class, which won't be till after Christmas, it would be great if you could be on the call, because it will be really useful for you to engage with the testing we'll be doing. It should also be a lot of fun. So it's been a mammoth TED class, and it would still be nice to have one exercise squeezed in either this week or next. But now I'd like to open it up, the teleclass, that is, your questions and comments. So if you'd like to unmute yourselves by pressing *7, it'd be great to hear your thoughts, comments, and reflections. Hello.
Hello.
I was getting worried.
Yes, it went very quiet.
Yes, it is. Are you asleep out there?
Annie, it's just fine.
Hi. So,
well, this is thoughts. Yeah, this has been fascinating, just this whole notion of where you want to go, and I realize it's something... I mean, I'm really at a loss. It's something I don't think I've thought about ever in my life. I think I've been in sort of react mode my entire life, not in act mode. And it's a new concept. And I think you had said something to Helen earlier about, you know, how would you know or what would be in the picture if things were different? And I realized that what would be there would be me. You know, what I think about is everything but myself, and I think when I'm in the center of the picture, that's when I'll know that my life has changed.
Right. And how will you get to the center of the picture?
You know, and it's I don't know. I'm at a loss. I've
given you a clue in this teleclass. And I'd rather not tell you, because it's more useful for you if you work it out for yourself. So how do you get to be at the center of the picture?
I mean, I think there are clues in my head, and I just have to get back to, I have to get back to it. I think I just have to turn my focus inwards, but that's very hard for me to do.
Yep, and how do you get to be at the center of your world?
I think I have to figure out what it is I want. I think I've been concentrating too hard on filling a role, on finding a place for myself, you know, being useful or something like that. And certainly part of the appeal of my relationship was that I was very useful. There was a role to fill. He wasn't a child, but he was as needy as one. And
he was a child, he's just chronologically older.
Yes. So it may be a fear in me of actually, you know, facing my own life. It may have been easier to be with someone who was a complete distraction.
Well,
there may be,
there may be
a hurdle to get over, you know, on my part. There may be a wall, you know, or I don't know if it's just ignorance. I think there's also some resistance on my part.
Well, it sounds respectfully, it sounds like you're giving yourself a good flogging for not being, for not having answers.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't like floggings. We've done it. We've had enough floggings, all of us, one way and another. So we don't have the answers now. And that really is a cause for compassion towards yourself. Isn't it interesting that you've reached the age that you've reached, knowing so little about who you are and how you put yourself at the center of your own world? And actually, you could say, isn't that awful? You could say, there are an awful lot of women who are exactly where I am now. And the great thing is that I now have the opportunity to change that.
I do feel
that's
that.
Who you are.
Yeah, I do feel a sense of opportunity and of, you know, sort of a blessing in disguise that I have reached this point.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of figuring out how to harness that.
Yes. I was reading something today about sort of opportunities, you know, these things are gifts in disguise, and God, how I hate the wrapping paper.
Yeah, right.
and as I was thinking, so what you're thinking, it sounds as if you're almost thinking in terms of life as a linear progression, that your life has to be a linear progression, that when you know what you want to do, that will help you to know who you want to become.
Right. I do think that way.
And, you know, perhaps it's the other way, that you'll start pursuing a path and you don't know where that's going to take you, but it will take you further on. Just if I can just share my own trajectory with you for a moment, just what I mean. I was in this marriage and I've been doing a PhD, and I suddenly decided I wanted to be an outside caterer, as you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into outside catering and I wrote a couple of academic books. And from there, I went into the Alexander Technique because my back hurt. And from there, I went into the personal development world. So there was no logical sequence in what I did. But each thing helped grow me as a person, pieces of me at a time. So everything I did enriched me and grew me. And that, I think, can be the way it works, that whatever you do, whether it's what you're going to be doing long term or not, doesn't particularly matter, because you will grow and know yourself through it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I think I'm sort of stuck on making the right choice, but maybe there is no right choice.
Maybe there are many right choices. I think most of the choices we make are right, but the issue is how we use them, how we use whatever comes out of them. You know, because everything we do has good and bad associated with it, and it's how we choose to interpret it.
That's very true.
So, and there is this obsessive fear of getting things wrong when you've been in an abusive situation, because there's such a price to pay when you get it wrong.
Yes? Yeah, definitely.
So you've got to get it right. But actually, no, you've got to make the best choices you can. You've got to start opening up to your intuition and allowing your heart to speak about where you go, and trusting that it really will work out.
Mm-hmm.
Does this make sense? And we still haven't left, and I'm still not getting, oh God, my teeth are all over the place. I'm still not letting go of the question, how do you put yourself at the center of your world?
Right.
Because it's still important. Do we have any clues from the floor, ladies? Nobody wants to get it wrong, do they?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here we go. Why don't you actually start visualizing yourself at the center of your world, visualizing yourself in the scenarios of your world? Does this make sense?
Yes, it does.
So instead of just, you know, oh, I can be this or I can do that, actually visualizing yourself in that scenario, being at the center of whatever it is and enjoying whatever it is. You know, and having a meaningful experience. I think when I started off as an outside caterer, I visualized myself as a skivvy. And God, I was. But, you know, why don't I envisage myself, yourself, as being at the center of whatever it is, doing meaningful work in a constructive way with enough time off and all the support we need and friends and whatever else and respect and consideration and laughter and whatever else we want. Does that make sense?
It does. And I wonder, is that what sort of self-actualized people do naturally? I mean, I guess some people don't have to be taught that skill.
I think some people don't have to be taught that skill. You know, some people have just, I think that it is actually our natural conditioning if life doesn't get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking about my little dog, Basil, and all little dogs who have, you know, loving homes. And they just swan into a room and expect people to adore them, and people normally do. They expect to have a good relationship with everybody they see. It's just ingrained into them. And I think that we human beings also, if we're left to ourselves, if we haven't got the negative chatter going on in our head, would just naturally make those assumptions, and people would naturally respond. And this was sort of, I'm a little tired at the moment, but this was tying itself up with another piece of information which really shook me when I discovered it. I did some research on successful entrepreneurs a while back, about what went on in their head. It was about modeling them, learning how they did, what was going on in their head. And my favorite woman was a woman who said, very large woman, who's very matter of fact. She'd actually had a father who was wealthy but put her down, said, you'll never amount to much. And he said, and she said to him, just watch me, Buster. And she said to me, well, I need about 15 million a year. She said to me, I'm going to need about 15 million. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty good to me. And she said, 15 million a year. And I was going, that sounded pretty good to me, I have to say. But the interesting thing that all these entrepreneurs had in common was they had virtually no self-talk. They had a pleasant silence in their head most of the time. And occasionally, when things went wrong, they would have a little bit of negative self-talk. And that was not comfortable for them, and they were quite good at shifting their state and getting themselves back into a position where the self-talk, which was all negative, went. Now, you've got quite a nice legacy, a nice stockpile of negative thought in your head. We've all had that.
Yes.
And in order to shift that, the most effective way is to start seeing and visualizing and believing yourself in positive scenarios. And my own experience has been that you have to run those positive scenarios. You consciously have to run them through in your head. But after you've done it, a little while, then what you've told yourself just becomes normal, and you end up being able to do things that used to be fraught with negative self-talk without that kind of degree of consciousness at all. You just can go into those situations with that kind of default normal silence in your head. So yes, you have to do it consciously, make the shift. And then my guess is that you actually don't need to do that at all. It just becomes second nature and natural. Just like You know, you probably don't think about how you bend down to tie your shoelaces up.
Right.
Because it's just been programmed into you. So what I've been struggling to say is that by using these positive visualizations and techniques, you can then program this positive approach that is so much more useful into you. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting observation about the entrepreneurs, yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing to me. And is that reasonably clear?
Yeah, no, thank you.
Yeah. So really, I'm not a great lover of the sort of every day, in every way, my life goes on getting better, because that doesn't really work for me. And it doesn't work for a lot of people, because that kind of affirmation, you're telling yourself something that you don't actually believe. But when you actually work with your unconscious mind in the ways that we've been talking about, and give that a little bit of help and support, then it becomes very much easier to shift from negativity to positivity. Because instead of fighting yourself, you're actually enlisting your own support. And when you ask your unconscious mind nicely to do what you want it to do, it will usually oblige. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and just in case that sounds a little far-fetched, whenever I've got something to write and I don't have long, that my simple way of doing it is to go to bed and say to my unconscious mind, look, I really want, you know, I want this idea to come out tomorrow fully formed. I really appreciate you doing that, because otherwise it's going to be an agony. I don't want to do it the slow way. So please go into bed tonight, totally relaxed. I want that idea there, just ready to write down on the page tomorrow. And there's this moment when it's a bit uncomfortable because, you know, you don't have a sign out on your forehead saying idea present and correct. But when I sit down, or at a certain point in the day, I just have this awareness that I can sit down and do something, that it's there, and out it trots. That's how powerful it is.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It's, I mean, I've done that with problems. I say, well, I'll put it in the back of my mind, or it'll come to me, and it does.
Yeah.
So your mind is working things. Yeah, that's true.
Yes, and I'm a little bit more specific. Instead of saying, you know, I'll put it on my back burner, I say, unconscious, please, can deal with this one. I'm stuck. And it does.
That's very interesting.
So amazing resources that we have, and an amazing resource for turning yourself around from, you know, the negative self-talk to a much more useful state. So, it's midnight here. We need to stop. Has this been helpful?
Yes, lots to think about.
Yes, good.
Lots to think about. It's almost, I'll be very, very brief, Annie, but it's, I just think when I look back, there was a lot of being in a fog, being fuzzy, not clear.
Oh, yeah.
And dumbed down. And just listening today, it's around being more focused and having, you know, some strategies to draw on. And, yeah, it's more purposeful way of thinking. And, and that's been useful. And your visualization, we have a thing here with the Indigenous people. They say you can sing things to you. And I think that's that thing about the subconscious, you know. And so that makes a lot of sense for me and very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the image of the fog. I knew that one well. I think I lived quite a lot of my life in a pea super.
Yes, absolutely, and yeah, lots of self-talk and fog, and you know, just wallowing in the mud. And I do far less of that now, and that's really much more helpful.
Good, good. So, right, I think we shall stop here, and we start again in January. I'll send you details along with the instructions for how to download this call, and have some wonderful time for yourselves this Christmas. Christmas can be the hardest time, but make some time for yourselves and maybe spend a little time in visualizing how you want your future Christmases to be.
Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing you in 2011.
Okay. Have a nice Christmas, Annie.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.